confidence. One reporter who checked found out later that only 9 committee members had actually voted. 5 had not shown up, and 7 had abstained. But the 9 votes had been for Moses. When the fair's second season was opened, he was still in charge. But holding on to the fair did Moses little good. The second season was worse than the first. There was the continuing drumfire of audit revelations, and when the press managed to tear its attention away from those, it focused not on attractions, but on attendance, and it was all too clear that in that area this fair was to be no different from its predecessors. Day after day, the gate count ran below that of corresponding days the previous year. The press headlined the attendance and wrote crisis stories about it and its consequences, failing exhibitors, increasing lack of maintenance, which further discouraged people from attending, and, blaming it on Moses' decision to increase prices, laughed at it, a Newsday column saying, "In truth, Moses must be credited with a striking improvement over last year's World Fair. He has done away with the fair's most unpleasant feature, people." He twisted and turned, seeking a way out of the nightmare that kept looming closer every day as the end of the fair grew closer, cutting maintenance and security forces to the bone, firing employees by the hundreds, slashing salaries, eliminating expense accounts. He began arranging quiet park department allocations for Flushing Meadows Park, set Triborough executives to work figuring out how much of the authority's money could be spent on the fair site. But the damage had been done long before, when he had authorized the spending of the tens of millions collected before the fair opened. It could not be corrected now. His worst fears were becoming reality. His auditors told him there would be no money to repay the city the $24 million it had advanced, no money to create the great new chain of parks that had been the main reason he had taken the fair job in the first place, no money even to create the Robert Moses Park on Flushing Meadows of which he had dreamed. He was, he realized, going to be in the same humiliating position in which that wastrel skirt chaser Grover Whalen had found himself, unable to repay more than a few cents on the dollar of the notes the fair had floated, perhaps unable even to demolish the buildings of exhibitors who had gone bankrupt and could not demolish them themselves, so that the principal monument to this enterprise, which he had believed would resurrect his reputation and reburnish his name, would be heaps of moldering wreckage and debris. Absolute disaster was staved off by the last 3 weeks. Going into those weeks, the total attendance for the second season had not been the 37,500,000 that would have enabled the Fair Corporation at least to break even for the season, but only 17 million. The Fair Corporation, practically penniless, was paying its bills from week to week. With schools back in session and the weather turning chilly, there was no logical reason to expect any dramatic change in the lack of public interest that had prevailed for 2 years. But as October began and the press began reminding the public that the fair was in its last month, crowds suddenly began pouring in as if the populace of New York had suddenly realized that, despite all the adverse publicity, they wanted to see the exposition and take their children to see it. And as if, having seen it once, not through Fred Ferretti's eyes, but their own, they liked it, loved it in fact, and came back during the short time remaining as many times as possible. For 2 years, Moses had been waiting, practically in vain, for 250,000 days. Now, suddenly, there was one such day after another, and then, for the weekends of 3 weeks, 500,000 days, as on 6 triumphant Saturdays or Sundays, 500,000 persons paid their $2.50 and pushed through the turnstiles. During its final 3 weeks, 7 million persons came to the fair, pouring into the Fair Corporation's barren exchequers, through admission and parking fees and concession percentages, more than $13 million. If attendance had continued at its pre-October pace, the corporation would have had a deficit of more than $24 million. As it was, its deficit was reduced to only about $10 million. On closing day, his auditors informed Moses that there was $11,580,000 in the bank to be used either to repay the $23 million in notes or for the restoration of Flushing Meadows Park. The bankers and other noteholders expected that he would use his money to repay his debts. But Moses had other priorities, and he announced them with his usual flourish. At a post-fair executive committee meeting, attended by several bankers who were among the largest noteholders, a fair official announced that the corporation had a surplus of $11,600,000. The committee applauded, the bankers looking rather relieved. But then Moses stood up. There was just one thing, he said. He wasn't going to use any of the $11,600,000 to pay them. The money was going to restore the fair site and create the park. At least two of the investment bankers, W.H. Morton of W.H. Morton & Company, and Frederick H. Brandy, president of Dillon Reed & Company, leaped to their feet to protest. Moses favored them with one of his prize glares. The big head tilted back, and it was down his nose that he was looking at the bankers when he replied that he did not feel any particular sense of responsibility to noteholders, who ride around in big limousines with telephones in the back. By the bankers' code, Moses was committing the original sin, losing them money. They instituted legal action to compel him to use the money to pay his debts, but they were helpless. Eventually they were, in a compromise, to receive a total of $3 million, bringing the total return on their $30 million investment, $7 million had of course been prepaid, to $10 million, or about 33 cents on the dollar, ironically just about the same as Grover Whalen had repaid his investors. The money left, $8,600,000, wasn't enough for the $29 million chain of parks, of course, just as it wasn't enough to repay the city's $24 million. But it was enough, together with $6,576,000 from Triborough coffers, various quiet park department allocations, and enough money from the Hexter Foundation to create a zoo, to enable the Fair Corporation to demolish the pavilions of bankrupt or impoverished exhibitors, to clean up the fair site, and to do at least a little park work on Flushing Meadows. The park he was able to build there may not have been the great park he had envisioned, but at least it was a park, with a Hall of Science, the Federal and New York State pavilions, the columned skating rink, and a Unisphere, to remind future generations of Robert Moses' World's Fair. Looming over the whole park from beyond its northern end was the Shea Stadium that was his answer to the Colosseum of the Caesars. And the park was, of course, surrounded by his great roads, the clover leaves and broad ribbons of concrete that to him represented beauty and that were his trademark. They tied up the park with neat, clean, sweeping borders, delineating the outskirts so sharply that from the air the green was sliced off by gray as sharply as by a knife, nothing left over on the edges, nothing frayed, making it a landscape by Moses, bearing his signature as plainly as if he had scrawled it onto the concrete in giant letters. And he considered the landscape beautiful. On the day, filled with pageantry, he gave the Flushing Meadows back to New York, he said in a statement entitled Beauty for Ashes, "The fair cannot entirely complete this great work so that nothing further will be required. Every step, however, follows an ultimate plan, which is realizable in the not-distant future. We believe it is no exaggeration to say that two world's fairs have ushered in, at the very geographical and population center of New York, on the scene of a notorious ash dump, one of the very great municipal parks of our country." Public monies spent under Robert Moses' direction during preparations for the 1939-40 World's Fair to make the Flushing Meadows a feasible park site came to $58,842,000. For the 1964-65 World's Fair, Robert Moses Fair Corporation spent on permanent park improvements $22,256,000. Robert Moses Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority spent on permanent park improvements $6,576,000. The city of New York spent $31 million. The state of New York spent at least $12 million, and probably far more. The federal government spent $12 million. The public monies spent during this fair on permanent improvements to make Flushing Meadows a park thus came to a total of at least $83,832,000. For the two fairs, the total was at least $142,674,000. And no one even suggested it be named after him. In computing the balance sheet for the 1964-65 World's Fair in relation to what its president had hoped to get out of it, its effect on his popularity must weigh heavily indeed on the debit side. The methods he had employed in building and running the World's Fair were not new. He had been using them for 40 years. The only thing different was that this time the world had seen them. Formerly, he had employed these methods behind the cloak of public authorities, which kept the public from seeing these methods. The fair had given the world a look at his methods. And by so doing, the fair had destroyed what was left of the legend of Robert Moses. The great Universal Exposition that had been supposed to rehabilitate his popularity had instead destroyed the last of it, and destroyed it beyond repair. When the fair came to a close on October 17, 1965, Robert Moses was revealed to the public in all his egotism, arrogance, and ruthlessness. He was, in fact, portrayed, in the press's emphasis on the $100,000 a year in salary and expenses and the escrow account, as something worse than he was, greedy for money. He was in public disrepute so great that his name had become a symbol for things the public hated. For the ordinary public official in a democracy, such a state of affairs would have meant loss of power. If he had been an elected official, he would have been ousted from office by the public at the next election. If he had been an appointed official, he would have been ousted from office by the official who had appointed him, probably not in a matter of months, but in a matter of weeks, if not days. But Robert Moses was an official of a public authority. The public had no voice in whether or not he stayed in office. The power he wielded in the position to which the mayor had appointed him made him, once in power, virtually immune to the mayor's authority, as the new mayor, entering office shortly after the fair drew to a close, was soon to find out. Mary Moses' worship of the husband who was her hero, and her obsessiveness with public recognition of his greatness, had grown more noticeable. Once, an architect, meeting her at a party, mentioned casually to her that he had been one of the young architects who had worked for the park department under WPA. "Anybody who is of any importance in the city has worked for Mr. Moses at one time or another," she replied haughtily. Her response to the increasing criticism of her husband during the 1950s was violent. So violent that friends felt it helped worsen her fast-failing health. Says Becky Vollmer, "Her whole life was Robert. Once they went to dinner at the Salzburgers, this was during the 50s, when there first started to be criticism, and Iphigenie got Mary to one side and said, 'Mary, why does Robert antagonize people so terribly?' Mary was wild, as if Iphigenie Salzburger thought Robert deliberately antagonized people. It was just that some people refused to understand." Mrs. Moses was, in her early 60s, an old woman. Her nervous troubles had not been solved, leading to further hospitalizations in the Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic, and she developed severe arthritis, which led to her increasing confinement in a wheelchair. Someone had to order his shirts, see that he had money, take care of him, his daughter Jane says. For a while, Jane herself did so. She was now divorced and living at her parents' Babylon home. Moses, so youthful and vital, showed little sign of advancing age. One could mark the development in Moses' career by the women he selected as companions. During his reforming, idealistic period, he had been in love with Mary, an idealistic reformer. During his alliance with the North Shore robber barons period, he had been publicly affectionate with a North Shore robber baroness. As a politician involved with Tammany Hall, the relationship most subject to gossip among his aides and acquaintances was a canny, tough female city commissioner. Within the tight little Triborough empire, social affairs were commonplace. Now, one of Moses' secretaries recalls, they began getting Mary II to go along with the boss. Mary Grady, Mary II, as she became known in the empire, was a secretary 28 years younger than Moses. Soon their friendship was an open secret. Joe Ingraham became aware that, at every party Moses attended, Mary Grady would be there in the background. Moses had never taken a vacation without Mary I, but in 1952 she was too ill to accompany him to Florida. After that, he began taking Mary II instead. His wife was affected with heart trouble and what a friend calls all the ailments of old age. She was confined more and more to the Thompson Avenue house in Babylon now. He lived more and more in the Gracie Terrace apartment in the city. It wasn't, emphasized the Bulmers, who had known them for years, that he was mean to her. Whenever he saw her, he was as courteous and friendly as ever. He would often drive out to Babylon on a Sunday to have lunch with her. And it was for her that he made what for him was a supreme sacrifice, his reputation for being above money. It was, after all, at least partly to pay for her round-the-clock nursing care that he had subjected himself to public criticism by accepting the $100,000-a-year World's Fair post. The Vollmers feel that there was a reason why Mary entered her final decline in 1959. It was quite noticeable that she got worse when the real criticism of him began. Becky says, "I don't think she could stand it. It was just that he turned his back on her. He was able to withdraw, to turn his back on personal problems. He withdrew from Mary. She could be at a hospital, and he would be at a party someplace at the same time, acting the same as ever, as if nothing was wrong." Mary Sims Moses was virtually completely bedridden after 1962. She lived in Babylon, her husband mostly in New York. She died on September 5, 1966, at the age of 81. Her obituary in the Times said, accurately, "From the day she exchanged a reformer's role for that of a housewife 51 years ago, Mrs. Moses was content to remain in the shadow of her husband." Less than a month later, her husband, 77, married Mary Grady, 49. Chapter 48. Old Lion, Young Mare. "He paweth in the valley, and rejoiceth in his strength. He goeth on to meet the armed men. He saith among the trumpets, Ha, ha! And he smelleth the battle afar off, the thunder of the captains, and the shouting." Job, chapter 39, verse 25. For 20 years, mayoral candidates had been vying for Moses' support. In the 1965 campaign, none of the three candidates had. On the contrary, they had all criticized him. The conservative candidate, an admirer, had been muted in his criticism, but the two major candidates had attacked his park, transportation, and housing policies, everything, it seemed, that he had done or was planning to do for New York. And the one who had been elected was the one who had meant it. Hardly had he been elected when John V. Lindsay appointed as park commissioner Thomas P.F. Hoving, author of a white paper on parks that had attacked Moses' policies. But there was no real power left in the park department, hadn't been for years. The real power was in highways, and the two posts Robert Moses held were in that area, the only two posts he had left: chairmanship of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. His term did not expire until June 30, 1970, 18 months after Lindsay's was to expire, and City Arterial Highways Representative. Lindsay said he could take those posts away too. Well, that was all right. Moses didn't mind him saying that. That was of a piece with his rhetoric during the campaign, and a new mayor had to pay at least lip service to that rhetoric after his election. But the funny thing was that John Lindsay really believed he could. Robert Moses knew different. He had lost enough power so that a tough, canny mayor, skilled in the ways of New York politics, could have given him a hard fight. But his shrewd old eyes had taken their measure of John Lindsay the first time the two men had ever sat down and talked, and he knew that Lindsay wasn't the mayor to do it. Shortly after his election, the handsome young mayor-elect had invited him down to his pre-inaugural headquarters at the Hotel Roosevelt for a discussion. Leaving for the meeting, Moses had been tense. A barometer of his feelings had been the fact that he had accepted Lindsay's invitation instead of making Lindsay come to him. But returning, he was smiling and relaxed. "If you elect a matinee idol mayor," he told aides, "you're going to get a musical comedy administration." Lindsay had talked about the power brokers in our city, but, when pressed by reporters, had never identified them. "Who are the power brokers? They know who they are," was his reply. Possibly because, as he was to demonstrate during his mishandling of the first crisis to confront him, a transit strike, he didn't really know who they were. He was going to find out, though, the hard way. During the pre-inaugural period, his bright, eager young aides had been working out the transportation merger that his transportation white paper had so blithely proposed during the campaign. It sounded so easy to these articulate, cocky young men. The transit authority had a deficit, which was imposing an intolerable burden on the city's financial structure. The Triborough Bridge Authority had a surplus. What could be more logical than to use the one to offset the other? The philosophy of the new administration was, at the time, militantly pro-mass transit, anti-automobile. Taking away Triborough's funds, with which the authority would otherwise build new automobile facilities, and using them to improve the subways, dovetailed with that philosophy, particularly if the new agency were to raise tolls on Triborough's bridges and place them for the first time on non-authority bridges so as to further discourage automobile traffic into the city, a proposal toward which the new administration was leaning. All they were doing, Lindsay's aides could feel, was finally putting into force the proposals reformers such as Citizens Union and City Budget Commission study groups had been advocating for years. What was hard about it? Both authorities, Transit and Triborough, were controlled by the city, weren't they? And John Lindsay was the city now. The ignorance of some of these men concerning the true nature and powers of public authorities would have been ludicrous if it had not been the city's future that ignorance was jeopardizing. Lindsay was, moreover, full of confidence, overconfidence, and optimism about his ability to run the city. He was going to be another LaGuardia, with one exception. LaGuardia had never gone on to be president, as he was sure he was going to. Lest anyone miss the comparison with the greatest mayor New York had ever had, Lindsay had hardly been inaugurated when he had LaGuardia's portrait moved out of another spot in City Hall and into his office, along with LaGuardia's desk, and was, in an interview with A.M. Rosenthal of the Times, making it clear that he doesn't intend to be the chairman of the board. He intends to run the city. "I would call it a style not of tight control, but of total supervision." Lindsay was going to be in complete charge. A man who stood in their way, who was a dinosaur out of another age. How old was the old bastard, for God's sake? 77? Christ! A cranky, cantankerous, ludicrous figure they did not consider an obstacle at all. Because they laughed at him, they thought everyone laughed at him, or at least anyone whose laughter was worth anything. They mistook his deafness for senility, seemed to think they were dealing with an old man, but they were reformers themselves, or men parroting the phraseology of the reformers. And Robert Moses had been taking care of reformers for 40 years. It wasn't rhetoric that was going to determine control of the transportation program in New York City. It was resolutions, the bond resolutions, the contract covenants of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. It wasn't polemics that were going to count in any confrontation. It was power. John Lindsay and his glib young aides had the polemics. The grim old ruler of Randall's Island had the power. More, he knew how to use power. There was a phrase he employed in discussing Lindsay's merger proposal that had a certain significance. It was, he said, Ripper legislation. Ripper legislation, a phrase denoting legislation passed to remove an official from power indirectly when it is impossible to do so directly, was a phrase out of another age. It had not been in general use since the 1920s. The significance lay not in the phrase, but in the fact that the man using it was still around, in power, 40 years later. He was still around because he had managed to hold on to power for decades. These men, with their first taste of power, laughed at him. He had not only tasted power, but held it longer than many of these men had been alive. Did Lindsay think he had the ability to outsmart Robert Moses? Robert Moses had outsmarted LaGuardia. From the very same post from which Lindsay was trying to remove him, a president of the United States, at the peak of his popularity and power, dedicated to his destruction, had tried to remove him, and that president had failed. These rash young men thought he was only Robert Moses of the World's Fair and Title I. He was also Robert Moses of Timber Point and Jones Beach and Hither Hills, of the Northern State Parkway and the Triborough Bridge and the Cross Bronx Expressway and the Bay Ridge Approach. He was Moses of Messina, Moses of the Niagara Frontier. This was their first real battle. He came to it scarred with the wounds of 100 battles, battles he had won. Lindsay maps plans to slash Moses' power, the headlines read. Moses sat in his lair up on Randall's Island and grinned, the grin of the old lion. On January 13, 1966, Lindsay announced that legislation creating a new, centralized transportation authority that would merge Triborough with the Transit Authority and make its surplus available for subway operation, and empowering him to name the chairman of the new agency, would shortly be sent to Albany. A reporter asked him if he foresaw any difficulty getting the legislature to pass it. No, he said with a confident smile, he didn't. At another press conference several days later, he said he had no reason to believe that Moses will not go along with the plans. Did the mayor have any reason for his opinion? A reporter asked. No, he said with his boyish, winning grin. He had not seen anything definitive from Mr. Moses, but I have not seen any signs of hostility from Mr. Moses either. Don't start fights where there aren't any. Lindsay's aides, including legal aides, were just as confident in private. Moses was beaten, they told reporters, and he must know it. His era was over. Whether he liked it or not, he was going to go. Not one of the brigade of lawyers striding so confidently through the corridors of City Hall appeared ever to have heard of bond covenants. They were to hear of them shortly, however. On January 20th, there was delivered to all newspapers and radio and television stations in New York a memorandum in opposition to the Lindsay proposal, signed by Moses and his 2 Triborough co-commissioners. The memorandum included a legal opinion by former Corporation Counsel Pruce, Triborough Counsel Liebwall, and one of the nation's most respected experts on municipal bonds, Franklin S. Wood, of Hawkins, Delafield & Wood. The holders of bonds are the beneficiaries of independent contractual obligations by the authority. Any attempt to alter these contractual rights by legislation designed, perhaps, to divert pledged revenues would be plainly invalid. Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution forbids any state to pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. The appropriation of authority monies to such a purpose would contravene provisions of the New York State and United States constitutions. Such legalisms were not meat for the media. It all but ignored them, playing up the accompanying Moses broadside, which said merger proposals are poorly advised, spring from panic and not logic, solve no problems, and create additional ones. The indifference of the media was a shame. Emphasis on and explanation of this point could have begun at last the education about the political realities behind the powers of public authorities that the public had been needing for 30 years. Incredibly, the new administration still didn't get the point, as it didn't get the point of some other hints in Moses' statement, such as his comment that Triborough is the only agency with the personnel or funds to perform highway planning and coordination. If Triborough is destroyed, the city is likely to lose, at least in the next 5 years, while alternative planning and administrative forces are developed, hundreds of millions of dollars of federal and state highway aid. The effect of such loss upon the city, its construction industry, and its labor forces will be catastrophic. That statement was a rallying call to the forces that exerted so large a degree of control over the legislature, which alone could affect the merger Lindsay was so blithely predicting. But the new administration appeared not to understand this. It was through not only his Triborough chairmanship, but his informal post as City Arterial Highways representative, that Moses represented to the construction industry and labor forces hundreds of millions of dollars of federal and state highway aid. Remove him from the arterial post, and half of his remaining power, already so drastically reduced, would be gone. And removing him from that post would not require legislative action. Removal could be accomplished merely by sending him a letter. But incredibly, while Lindsay wanted Moses out of the arterial post, he did not understand its importance. Believing the Triborough chairmanship to be all that mattered, he thought the letter could wait. And it waited, all through the ensuing fight. Joining a walk-in against a Moses Highway, the Richmond Parkway through the Staten Island Greenbelt, Lindsay aides made a pretty picture, particularly briskly striding Commissioner Hoving, who explained to reporters that his multicolored hiking outfit was multinational, with the red ski cap from Austria, the white turtleneck sweater from Ireland, the purple scarf from Iceland, etc. This parkway fight is a classic case of conservation versus modern times, he said, and he, like the other aides along, had not the slightest doubt that modern times would win. Shortly before the final draft of the merger proposal was completed, Lindsay made the gesture of sending transportation aide Arthur E. Palmer to see Moses and ask him personally to resign. But the tone in which Palmer couched the request was as condescending as his attitude. Palmer was told to make it clear to Moses that he was being given an opportunity to resign to save the face he would lose by being forced out. And it was only a gesture anyway. The new mayor all too obviously felt he was being charitable, that Moses had no choice but to go. Palmer was to recall that, from the beginning and during all this, Lindsay never had the slightest respect for Moses or comprehension of Moses' powers. Lindsay's attitude was, what he used to say was, for Christ's sake, throw the old bastard out on his ear. Interestingly enough, it was Palmer, an older, quieter man, despised by Lindsay's glib young men because he didn't talk as fast, or, they thought, think as fast as they, who first grasped the facts in the situation, possibly because he had had the face-to-face meetings with Lindsay's opponent which the new mayor's other aides had not. There were three meetings. One was at Randall's Island, one was at Moses Gracie Terrace apartment, and one was at Moses' favorite booth in the Oak Room at the Plaza. None was at Palmer's office, or at any place he suggested, because Moses made it quite clear that if the mayor's new man in transportation wanted to meet him, he would have to do so at Moses' convenience. Moses' utter indifference to whether or not the meeting ever took place was hardly like the attitude of a desperate old man. Palmer found it, in fact, rather unsettling. Further unsettling was Moses' reaction to Lindsay's generous offer to let him save face. He wasn't in the least interested even in discussing it. Instead, he gave Palmer lectures. The conversations consisted of monologues during which he was giving me messages, some of which I got at the time, some of which I got later, some of which I don't think I've ever gotten. Messages about power in the city and how he controlled it, that the mayor didn't have the power to unhorse him, that he wasn't going to be intimidated, that he didn't propose to change his program, which included the Bushwick Expressway, the Lower Manhattan Expressway, etc., that others had tried that scheme before, that there were a dozen other devices he could use, that he was prepared to cooperate with the mayor, but only on his own terms. Palmer, who was by no means as dense as Lindsay's aides considered him, may not have gotten all the messages, but he got enough. When he reported Moses' refusal to resign to Lindsay, the mayor asked him, "Well, do I fire him or not?" Palmer replied, he recalls, that, "According to the Triborough statute, you haven't got the power to fire him." Palmer's honesty apparently ended his rapport with the mayor. Lindsay appeared, Palmer was to recall, to cool toward him from that moment on. But Moses' message was apparently beginning to sink in, accompanied by other unpleasant facts of political life which Lindsay was beginning to learn. At a subsequent meeting, Palmer recalls, he received indications of a diminution in Lindsay's confidence, including one conversation in which the mayor enunciated, as though he had learned it for the first time, a virtual playback of Palmer's own words. "Don't forget, Moses has a lot of credit cards outstanding, and he's not going to be an easy guy to get out." Soon there were stronger indications. Someone in the administration had apparently read the bond covenants. The legislation as submitted to Albany no longer made any mention of the Triborough surpluses. All that was now proposed was a merger of the two authorities, and before the news of this Lindsay concession was released to the press, Palmer was dispatched again to Moses, not this time as an act of charity, but to try to make a deal based on their assumption that Moses still thought Lindsay would try to appropriate the surplus as well as merge the authorities. Since Moses was always stressing the sacredness of the bond covenants and saying that they revolved around the surplus, Palmer was to offer to do what Lindsay now knew he had no choice but to do anyway, leave the surplus intact, if Moses would agree to cease his opposition. Nothing revealed the inability of the new administration to comprehend Moses' power or his motives more clearly than did this offer, for it failed to take into account either the fact that Moses was really interested in keeping not surpluses but power, or the fact that he had the political clout to keep power without making any concessions at all. Moses' reaction, delivered in the Oak Room, was, in Palmer's recollection, to make his previous messages plainer, as if he had just realized that, in the person of John Lindsay, he was dealing with a pupil even slower than he had thought. "You keep asking me to cooperate with your mayor," he said. "How can I cooperate with anyone who's proposing to break the bond covenants?" Palmer said, "Mr. Moses, if you would cooperate, I don't think any breaking of the covenants would be necessary." Leaning across the table at Palmer, Moses said, "I wouldn't cooperate with that goddamned whippersnapper no matter what he did. He'll come and go. Triborough is going to be around for a long time." Palmer, after a pause, replied, "What you're really saying, Mr. Moses, is that these talks are really fruitless." At last, someone had gotten the idea. Moses leaned back with a smile. "Yes," he said, "that's about what I'm saying." On February 26th, John Lindsay had to make a trip to Kenosha. He had telephoned Moses for a meeting. "Certainly," Moses replied. "He would be glad to meet the mayor, at Randall's Island or Gracie Terrace. If the mayor wanted to see him, the mayor would have to come to him." And when, on February 26th, Lindsay came to Moses' apartment, Moses replied to his attempts to negotiate the issue by grabbing up a yellow legal pad and scribbling out on it a revision of the legislation Lindsay was proposing. The details of the revision are unknown, but both Moses and Palmer, to whom Lindsay gave the yellow piece of paper, are agreed on its purport. While it would create the Transportation Administration about which Lindsay had been talking, it would leave not only Triborough surpluses, but its independence untouched, along with the powers of its chairman and Moses' continuation in that post. It would leave Moses in power as firmly as before. And when Lindsay attempted to discuss the proposal, Moses wasn't interested in discussing it. The mayor could take it or leave it. At last, Palmer recalls, The mayor seemed to understand that Moses was sure he could win any showdown. Lindsay thought Moses was wrong. As the legislature moved closer to taking up his proposal, he and his aides were aggressively, boastfully confident that the old bastard's day was about over. In part, their optimism was based on the outcome of a meeting with Governor Rockefeller. At the meeting, held over dinner in the governor's Fifth Avenue apartment, the merger plan had been presented to Rockefeller and several of his aides, including his counsel, Saul Corbin, and a tall, burly man dressed in evening clothes, whom Richard M. Rosen, Lindsay's legislative aide, thought at first was one of the butlers, but who was introduced to him as Bill Ronan. He left early to attend a formal dinner elsewhere. So naive was the team representing the city that it wasn't until, after they left Rockefeller's apartment, they decided to go to Sardi's for a drink to discuss what had happened, the handsome young celebrities were very big at Sardi's, that they realized, as Rosen puts it, that we had been talking to Dr. Ronan about a plan that would have deeply affected the area he was interested in, that we had been giving a proposal that would compete with the things he was doing. We had felt, we admitted to one another, a little silly saying, when you get your state things together, it'll fit right in with what we're doing, as if we're trying to pull the wool over his eyes. No one's pulling the wool over Bill Ronan's eyes. Nonetheless, they were lulled by the governor's attitude. One member of the Lindsay team, who would discuss the meeting only on condition not only that he not be quoted about it, but that the author never reveal to anyone, any time, that he had ever agreed to talk to him about anything, says, "The governor was very favorable. My recollection is that the governor said he would support the Lindsay merger proposal. My recollection is that the governor said he could put it through quickly." Palmer says, "Rockefeller went over the legislation, and he undertook to get it passed. We all had dinner together and parted great friends." Rosen says, "There was never, at any time, a pledge of support, but we thought the governor liked the proposal conceptually, as an idea." Neither Rockefeller, Ronan, nor any of the governor's other aides would discuss the meeting. Lindsay certainly appears to have believed he had the governor's support. And even if he had doubts about the governor's word, the doubts would not have worried him overly. "To tell the truth," one of Lindsay's aides recalls, "we thought we could win up in Albany without it. To tell you the truth, we had no doubts about it." Interviewed by newsmen, mayoral legislative aide Rosen allowed himself to be just a little pontifical. "The way you handle legislators is with power," he said. And, he made clear, there was no doubt that the mayor of New York had the power in any matter so vital to the city's future. Everyone in Albany seemed to know what was going on with regard to John Lindsay's transportation legislation. Everyone but Lindsay's man in Albany, City Legislative Representative Rosen. The three leaders who made the decisions for the legislature were Assembly Speaker Anthony Travia, Assembly Minority Leader Perry B. Duryea, Jr., and Senate Majority Leader Earl Bridges. Senate Minority Leader Joseph Zaretsky had little real power. Moses came to me personally and through friends and said, "Look, you don't want this to happen to me, do you?" Duryea recalls. "And I said, no. Look, you don't have a Bob Moses come along in a state every day, and you don't just kick him out. Jim Evans, one of Moses' men in Albany, came to me and asked what could be done. I said, I don't like removing a guy by legislation. If Lindsay wants him out, let him be ballsy enough to do his own dirty work. And I convinced Bridges. But I also told Evans that I was of the minority party, and that he'd better get to Travia if he wanted to save Moses." By the time the proposed legislation came up for a public hearing, Travia had been gotten to, perhaps by Wagner, whose support had made him speaker. perhaps by a promise by Moses to eliminate from his highway plans a proposed cross-Brooklyn expressway through Travia's district, perhaps by Travia's county leader, Stanley Steingut, of the City Title Insurance Company, perhaps by a simpler reason, Travia's contempt, shared by Duryea, Bridges, and other legislators, for Lindsay as an intellectual lightweight who combined a truly astonishing ignorance of how things got done in Albany with an arrogance that led him to lecture them, privately and publicly, on how to do their jobs. Travia, Duryea, and Bridges could have swung the entire legislature to their side if they had needed to do so, but the legislature was on their side already, and if there were any recalcitrants, the leaders had allies. "Christ!" one senator was to say years later. "I still remember that one. That was the first time I ever got a call from Harry Van Arsdale himself. Himself, not his lobbyist. Harry Van Arsdale. Christ, everyone was calling. The banks, the leaders, you name it. There was enough muscle against that thing to have beaten anything." This is the quote of Lindsay's man Rosen on the subject. "I discussed the bill with the legislative leaders, and their reaction was generally favorable. A good response to the ideas that were presented." "They were playing games with Lindsay that year," says one reporter, a good one, covering Albany in 1966. "They kept saying, 'Amend it, amend it.' He'd make the amendments they asked, and then they'd ask him to make some more. I mean, everyone knew what was going on. I myself heard some guy, legislator, say to Rosen in the corridor, 'You're forgetting about that bill for this year, aren't you?' The guy was trying to hint to him, you know. But Rosen didn't even understand what the guy was trying to tell him. He started to seriously discuss with the guy why it wasn't really dead, why the mayor, was determined to have it passed." The contract out on the bill was executed with finesse. Travia told Rosen one day that a joint session of the Senate and Assembly Rules Committees would hold a public hearing on the proposed legislation. Recalls Rosen, "Travia said to me, 'All we want up there is the mayor and one other person. There'll be one or two people there from the other side. It'll be a friendly little thing, casual. The only reason we're having it at all, I was told, was that it was required by law.'" Rosen passed the message along to Big John, who appears to have seriously believed that a joint session of the two most powerful committees of the legislature, a session on a proposal to remove Robert Moses from power, would indeed be little more than a formality. On the morning it was scheduled to be held, the mayor flew up from New York, accompanied by only two aides, Corporation Counsel J. Lee Rankin and Executive Assistant Corporation Counsel Norman Redlich, neither of whom had even done much research into the matter to be discussed. Rosen met the three men at the airport, drove them straight to the Capitol, and, before leaving in the press room transcripts of the statement the mayor was going to make at the hearing, escorted the three men into the assembly parlor, in which the hearing was to be held, so that the mayor was already in the parlor when Rosen, in the press room, had his moment of truth. It came in the form of a handout, lying on the big table opposite the press room door, on which public relations men for the various legislative committees leave stacks of handouts for reporters' use. As Rosen put his stack down, he saw it lying there, and picked it up and read it. It was a handout announcing the public hearing, and the names of the speakers who were to appear at it. "A friendly little thing? Casual?" It was billed as the biggest event of the day, and, Rosen saw as his eyes followed the type down, the billing was justified. Appearing for the mayor's proposal would be one person, the unknown Redlich. Appearing for the other side would be, in addition to Moses, two former governors, Dewey and Paletti, one former mayor, Wagner, one former counsel to presidents and possibly the most prestigious Democratic attorney in the state, Rosenman, Brennan of the construction workers, Guinan of the transport workers, and others of the state's most powerful labor leaders, a representative of its most powerful bank, although David Rockefeller had sent a spokesman rather than appearing himself, its most powerful investment bankers, its largest stock brokerage firm, its leading and most powerful bond attorneys, and a platoon of representatives of other power groups ranging all the way from the Transit Authority to the Automobile Club of America. It was a lineup of most of the most powerful forces in the state, and it was a lineup arrayed against his boss. It was at that moment, all in a flash, Rosen recalls, that he realized that Lindsay had been led into a carefully concealed trap, one from which there was no escape. I didn't realize what had happened until I saw the handout. Then I said, Travi has fucked us. Running back to the assembly parlor, Rosen whispered these tidings to his boss. Even without this news flash, however, Lindsay was getting the message for himself. For as he stood in the assembly parlor, ready for the friendly, casual little get-together, jamming through the doors came television cameramen, radio and newspaper reporters and photographers by the dozen. And mixed among them, in addition to Travia, whom the mayor had expected to see, were Duryea, Bridges, and a half-dozen other key legislative leaders. Then, the old lion came into the room. The crowd, which had been milling around, parted to let him through, and he was suddenly face to face with his enemy. Lindsay half turned away, almost as if to pretend he hadn't seen Moses, but as the photographers rushed up, the mayor plunged his hands into his pockets and his face creased in a forced smile. A broad, wide grin broke across Moses' face, and for a moment the two men stood there, one young, handsome, dressed in a gold-buttoned blue blazer, precisely knotted striped rep, nervousness showing through the mask on his face. The other, old, lined, bald, tough, wearing a dark suit with jacket unbuttoned and plain dark tie pulled askew, and utterly relaxed. The photographers asked for a handshake. Lindsay hesitated. Sure, Moses said, and as Lindsay took his hand and Moses looked into his handsome face, the grin broadened into a smile of real delight. Then, abruptly, while Lindsay was still standing straight and still and keeping the smile glued on, Moses yanked his hand loose and whirled to walk away. There was command in that gesture. The circle around them parted. Followed by his entourage, he strode through it and slouched down casually on a red leather sofa against a wall. The sofa seated four, but no one took the other seats. At least three aides were standing behind him, standing, as he sat alone on that long sofa, says reporter Sidney Schanberg of the Times. When Schanberg approached him, he answered a couple of questions, and then he got churlish and turned to Ed O'Brien, and he said, Ed, I want to hear this testimony, meaning get rid of this shit. Then he looked up inquiringly, and another aide hurriedly ran over and whispered in Travia's ear. The speaker had been chatting with his own aides. He stopped abruptly, caught Duryea's eye, walked with him over to the hearing table, and even before sitting down, began pounding the gavel. Lindsay was the first at the lectern set up at the left end of the long table. Normally so poised, the mayor stared down with almost painfully obvious nervousness at the full battery of microphones before which he had been lured. He read like a schoolboy reciting his graduation speech, Schanberg says. Slouched on the couch, leaning on one hand, the other, big and still powerful, gripping his knee, Moses listened intently for a few minutes, even putting on the glasses with the concealed hearing aid so that he could be sure he heard. For a few minutes he was impassive, his lips pressed tightly together. But as he heard what Lindsay was saying, they turned up in a small smile. As the mayor continued, and it became apparent that he had no new cards to play, the smile widened a bit. And when the mayor got to his attack on Moses' proposed new highways and said, Under my administration, these proposals will never be accepted. Moses began to laugh, hastily putting a hand up to his face to hide the laughter when he saw a photographer lifting a camera in his direction. On receipt of Rosen's message, Lindsay, Rankin, and Redlich had hastily decided that the best thing to do was to get the mayor out of there as fast as possible, recalls one of those men. The mayor testified and said he had to go, and if there are any questions, Mr. Redlich will answer them. Then he headed out the door. Moses was obviously having real difficulty keeping from laughing out loud. If Albany was a jungle, with many of the principal beasts of prey gathered in the assembly parlor that day, an observer could, just by watching Robert Moses, have known that it was his jungle. He may have been an old lion, but John Lindsay wasn't the young lion to take his jungle away from him. And then, as one observer recalls, there followed the parade of the power brokers. Moses led off, as was fitting, relaxed at home, reading his speech without looking up, speaking in bored tones, making his points effortlessly. When some of the rank-and-file assemblymen present asked him a few mild questions, he answered, in Schanberg's phrase, "like your peasants." After a short while, he had had enough of it. He swung away from the lectern. The other power brokers followed. All the points necessary to be made were made by the people best suited to make them. The lawyers, that the proposed merger was illegal. The investment bankers, that it would destroy the businesslike nature of public authorities and would thereby make it impossible for them to raise money for needed public improvements. No one will buy a long-term revenue bond if the management of the project operates at the beck and call and whim of elected officials. Former government officials that the man proposing it didn't know anything about government. John J. Gilhooley, not only a transit commissioner but a former assistant secretary of labor, calling it a political power grab, inanely conceived and ineptly drafted. Legislation by rank amateurs in City Hall. Politicians that the man proposing it was power-hungry. It was, said Wagner, who had refused all previous overtures to attack his successor, but had trotted out his prestige at Moses' command, nothing more than a reach for power. The AAA, that it would unfairly penalize motorists who had paid for highway facilities through the tolls and taxes they have paid. The union leaders, that it was just plain bad. Worst of all, speaker after speaker emphasized, Lindsay's plan would deprive the public of the services of Robert Moses. "Make no mistake," Poletti said, "this arrogant and shameless ripper legislation, sponsored by Mayor Lindsay, is intended primarily to get rid of Bob Moses." "I have not, nor shall I ever join the pack that is currently snapping at the heels of Robert Moses," Gilhooley said. "His achievements are beyond the reach of the pea-shooters now attacking him. He will be honored by anyone who reads or writes the 20th-century history of the state of New York." But it wasn't what the speakers said that mattered, but what they represented. They represented power. Enough power to defeat anyone in the state, even a mayor of New York City, and to defeat him easily. As the perceptive Schanberg was to put it, the hearing was a pro forma charade. It was like the Green Bay Packers playing a high school team. Lindsay never had a chance. Moses didn't stay around to review the parade of power brokers he had marshaled, and there was no reason why he should. Lindsay should have. He might have lost face, but he would have learned something. He would have learned the identity of those power brokers he was always talking about. His foe had lined them up and paraded them before him. With his customary attention to detail, Moses had even arranged for a series of mopping-up actions to follow the hearings. On the following day, Brennan launched a new, all-out attack on Lindsay, charging the new mayor with sitting on $3 billion worth of construction projects by putting politics ahead of people. The construction projects listed, of course, were almost all Robert Moses projects. And the day after that, the Chase Manhattan Bank supplemented its previous opposition to the merger proposal by announcing that if the legislature should adopt it, it would, as trustee of $379,300,000 worth of Triborough bonds, sue to invalidate the legislation. A legal brief designed to demonstrate the illegality of such a contract-breaking move was being filed with the legislature's Rules Committee by the bank's law firm, Dewey Ballantyne.